Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms. It's September 6th, 2020, and welcome to episode 221 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and weird things that you find inside retro computers. But we'll get to that in a minute. First off, let's see how everybody is. Blake, let's start with you. How are you doing, sir?
I am doing well. Just spent a good chunk of the day outside in lovely, warm, but not too hot weather, hiking a new park on the Potomac shore that I had never found before. We had never visited before, so that was a nice outdoor adventure. Always makes you feel a little better when you're cloistered in here so much of the week. But yeah, doing pretty well. Can't complain more than anybody else, I suppose. So, all right. How about you, Paul?
Yeah, can't complain. Always seems like a challenge of some kind.
Oh, yes, I can.
I wouldn't want anyone to think I was complaining.
That's right. Yeah. The school year started just barely. I mean, like, I don't know. Anyway, I'm not even sure how I'm doing. It's that busy. So, oh. But
wow.
Okay. I appreciate that. I work for university, but I'm a little bit of a different role, not a professor. So, but I am still quite affected, certainly by the hustle and bustle of the beginning of the school year, which did begin, last Monday. So.
Yeah. Well, I know virtually. That at our university, a lot of the support staff is under a lot of strain, yeah. You know, because suddenly there's a lot of new stuff to support that they're not necessarily used to supporting.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, certainly being an OIT, I certainly have my finger on the pulse of what's going on in all the different areas. And yes, the help desk, tech support, that kind of thing. I build websites, so I'm building some new websites, but I'm not having to feel that kind of strain that the support people are. So yeah. It's kind of chaotic. Yeah. What about you, Earl?
Well, speaking of university, both my son and my daughter are going to graduate in the not too distant future. So that's exciting.
Wow.
My daughter has gone on to her last semester, actually on campus here, a little south of the Portland area. And I guess things are going okay. They're having to take a lot of precautions, obviously, because of COVID. And, the experience there, it's a small university, and pretty much everyone knows everyone on campus. And they put a real emphasis on that. In fact, their motto is be known. So they put a real emphasis on that. And right now, of course, the socializing and the fellowship is kind of difficult with everything that's going on, but she's doing okay. My wife's taking her a support package of groceries today. Nice. So not a starving student.
Nice. Nice. You're one of the things you're making me feel is old. I remember as you would be recording some of the RetroBits podcasts, which was your earlier show was the first retro computing podcast I'd encountered. And my daughter was, I think, a toddler when I started listening, and I remember when your kids were you would mention them in shows with some frequency, and that they were certainly not close to graduating college.
So, no. Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah, that's really kind of shocking to hear you say that they're about to graduate. So, yeah.
As well as to me,
no doubt. Yeah, I'm, we're still Still hard to believe my daughter's beginning high school day after tomorrow. So, yeah, I guess it's always that way. Shock.
It's fun to have a bunch of friends, though, in the retro computing community that I've been able to keep in touch with for all these years, podcasting since 2005. So it's actually, as they'd say these days, starting to be a minute.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly.
But, all right, well, we got a host topic here, and note to listeners, it could get gross because we're talking about weird things. Mine won't be. Mine's actually just kind of weird. But so, Blake, you said you had a few. Why don't you go first and tell us about things? Now, the topic is strangest things that we've found while working on retro vintage computers.
Yes, I think... let's see. So for myself, since around 2000, 1999, 2001, somewhere in there, I started collecting, which meant bringing in different systems on eBay. And there are lots of opportunities to find things. You might have a box from a monitor from some person, and then a disk drive from someone else, and then an Atari 8-bit from another person, and then cables. So there's a lot of opportunities for finding objects and critters and things like that. I think actually the most offensive thing that I encounter is when a piece of hardware itself is so saturated with the smell of cigarette smoke that it's impossible to keep in the house. Like, I've had several devices where, like, someone that clearly smokes in the house with the windows shut, I've literally just had to – I didn't even want to foist it on someone in another sale. I just basically threw it away because I've never been able to get smells like that out. So that's the most disappointing, because then I can't use it. All the things I'm going to describe, which just a handful, I've kind of cleaned them out, and then the systems are in use or maybe on the shelf as a backup thing. So I guess the most notable /nasty was a desiccated mouse. There was a mouse that was inside of a, I believe it was inside of a 1541 disk drive, brown, and it had long since become a completely dry and flat item. But I felt something.
How did
knocking.
It even get inside of 1541?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think the top and bottom shell of the case didn't match perfectly in color, so I think it had been perhaps put together by different parts at some point. So maybe half of it was, an empty shell, and then they just, put the top on or something. I don't know. That was the most notable thing. That one kind of actually, raised the eyebrows. That's the best. That's the best I got. It's downhill from here, I guess. It's not a lot of happy things that have I found inside. I did find a baby rattle in a Apple IIe, and that was not gross, really. I tossed it, but, it was not as gross as, I guess, most typically, I think mouse droppings, like kicking around little rocks, like that's, I've found those in probably, 5 to 10 different devices. As you pick it up and, you hear a little bit of a shaking things in there. The most frequent thing I would encounter, and I've almost completed my offering here, is they weren't so much my machines, but they're machines that I serviced. I worked for a while I work for a university now. I work for a different university in Virginia quite a few years ago, as I was the one IT person for the nursing school at this university. And it was me, and I did all roles. And one of the things was hardware repair. So there'd be a system that broke, and you'd come in and look to see if it, had a capacitor or, something was wrong. And when I'd open them, some of the machines were from a lab. There was a lab next door, to my workshop/office. And these machines, you know, lest you think I'm going off course with retro, these now would be retro machines. At the time, they weren't, but we're talking 386s, you know, 486s. It was people that went to insert a CD-ROM into the drive, but actually slid it right between the top of the drive and the case. And so on about one quarter of the systems I brought in, it would usually be maybe, you know, Nirvana CD. There's somebody was trying to put on the headphones in the lab, almost always music albums, but they'd just be sitting right on top of that CD drive. And, yeah. You know, you'd pick it up and it would just slide out. And I ended up with a stack of those on my desk, maybe 15, 20 of them. So that was the most frequent thing, but not very not too gross, I suppose. And not even that strange, but I guess that's about all I have. You know, the baby rattle was kind of a curious thing, but I guess that mouse was the one that really stuck with me.
A no button mouse.
Mm-hmm. Yes, no button. It's a short cord, but it was cut off at a very short length. strangely, no connector. Yeah. So that's all I got. Have either of you fellows found anything of note inside of systems?
Yeah, what about you, Paul? You've got quite a collection of things you've accumulated that still threatens to fall over on you someday.
Right. And you know, you'd think that I would have more. but actually, the things I was going to talk about mainly were not really sort of like physical things in the systems. But I did want to share where the topic came from. The topic itself was suggested by Charles Mangan, who had opened up a computer and found some kind of interesting artwork on the chips. So in particular, the sort of first one that he posted a picture of on Twitter, it says 9664, you know, Intel 1980 Japan, and then it has this little like cartoon Grim Reaper and a cartoon mouse on it.
So little hieroglyphics of the chips,
but it's printed on the chip, you know, so it's some.
So it really came this way. Somebody didn't inscribe this
right
on the chip. Oh, how weird.
Yeah. And there are a couple of other chips as well that he had in there. I think it was the same machine. And it's sort of similar, kind of like, you know, there's the chip with just these little like cartoons on them. There's something that looks something kind of like a, or no, I don't know. It's like the back of a cat and the back of a something.
I think we should require this today.
Yeah.
I think all chips should come this way.
But it's kind of fun in a way, because it's these are things that you wouldn't expect anyone to actually see. You know, I mean, like most of the time this is hidden away inside a machine. Charles said these are all from a logic board of a DataView Spark laptop. Hmm. You know, I don't actually know this brand of laptop, but at any rate, you know, somebody who was designing the chips for these just figured, you know, it's boring to put nothing but the number on the chip. Might as well put mm-hmm. something kind of fun.
Wow.
That's pretty nifty. I think I focused more heavily on physical surprises in the machine. I will note, you urged me to note, mm-hmm. I found that some of the more recent devices that have been put together using FPGAs and that sort of thing that enable, you know, vintage machines to be more capable today, or even, you know, standalone FPGA machines that are, you know, modern / new, but meant to, you know, emulate in the FPGA way, a vintage computer. They often seem to have, you know, fanciful imagery on the actual board. If not poems, you know, quotes. I know, you know, the Amiga used to have the code names and some lyrics from different, Rock Lobster and Love Shack, the B-52s albums. That was their code name. But yeah, I think I have a C1, which is one of the earlier FPGA machines designed by Jerry
Ellsworth.
Yes, Ellsworth. And it has, I believe it has a small poem on it. You know, just these, I guess it seems like this is something that happens more and more with the actual board. But I can't say that I've ever seen any designs, you know, drawn or even certainly not etched into actual, you know, socketed or, you know, surface mounted chips. That's really cool.
Mm-hmm. There's something that's a little bit like this that was on the old Macintosh boards. So there's this character, Mr. Macintosh, which has it's. I mean, it's much less cute than the ones that were on Charles's chips there, but apparently on like very very early, you know. So this is a 1983 logic board, but it's just. I don't know. I don't even know what it's supposed to represent. It's kind of like a small-headed person. I always sort of looked at it as somebody who was like a spy or something like that, although I don't know why. Yes, like you have a Mr. Macintosh button, in fact. but it does sort of feel similar to that in a way. And I can sort of see why maybe the small-run homebrew things might have these kind of things on them, just because they're, you know, it's a single person. It's not, they're not doing their job. They're just, you know, goofing around with their hobby.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
I guess I never finished the story. The stories I was thinking about in terms of like things I've found in computers, mostly I have not found a physical, you know, physical stuff, in things, but yeah, I have found things where, like on discs that people have included with their things, there's all kinds of weird stuff. You know, like one in particular had letters that a person was writing to his estranged wife, apologizing for things. And you know, it's very, you know, it's very weird to get this, you know, private image into the lives of people you do not know. I mean, you will never know them. You might have interacted with, you know, their child who didn't know any of that stuff was on this old junk in the attic. You know, and might not know about this relationship between his parents, you know, and that sort of thing. It's hard to know what to do with stuff like that, because somewhere in there may be something that's interesting to archive. At the same time, it may be something that, you know, the child shouldn't know about. There's a couple of things that I'm thinking of specifically, obviously, but most of them I have archived the discs, and then they are just sitting in my, you know, on my hard drive. waiting for me to someday figure out if there's anything I can do with them. And maybe there isn't, but, yeah. So those are the weirdest ones, are that, you know, the sort of, I don't know, legal documents and apology letters and things like that, that you find in, you know, some miscellaneous WordPerfect directories.
Mm-hmm. That sort of reminds me, I don't think we talked about it on the show, but, it's come across my radar, some recent analysis of, you know, comments very much like you're talking about in, you know, in code listings, you know, like commented out. There's this typical criticizing your, you know, your coworker, or be warned, this algorithm must not be adjusted. You'll understand why in 100 hours. But yeah, things that are, you know, regrets of, you know, someone's wife that has left them, a final ode, that kind of thing. Reminds me of, it's very similar. Yeah.
Earl, did you have any similar things that you found?
Mine are extremely boring by comparison. when I think about it, I've received a lot of media over the years with retro computer donations, but they've been refreshingly free of personal anecdotes or personal business, that kind of thing, which I've been thankful for, because I didn't really need to see any of that. And so thankfully, things have been wiped before I received them, which is good. Likewise, I haven't encountered any animal carcasses or anything like that inside my retro computers. One time, one that I had, we had a small rodent problem in our garage at one point. And one of them had found their way into a Packard Bell 286 that I had out in the garage that was a donation. And honestly, that computer was so bad back in the day that I almost think, you know, good on those mice for using that as the machine that they made their nest in, because that almost seemed appropriate. I did find a couple of interesting things, though. One was a nice surprise, that I have a computer that was made by a major manufacturer as an OEM reference design, which was really fascinating. It's kind of a generic yellow wrap sort of computer. But when you pop it open, each of the chips on the motherboard, which was again a reference design for other people to look at and base their designs from, had a printed label on it. So if you can imagine the dozens and dozens of little chips, like even down to the 7400 series or whatever else you would have on the motherboard, every single one of them had a numeric label slapped on it, probably so that you could take some reference material and cross-reference it to exactly what chip was what and where it was located. I didn't have the reference material, so for me, that motherboard is just, it just has a bunch of junk labels on it that I've hesitated to take them off, though, because it's kind of historic preservation. You know, the way that motherboard was created and what it was used for seems interesting to me, so I haven't taken to scraping all those labels off yet, but found them fascinating.
It's possible someday the key might surface, too.
That's true. So the other nice surprise inside that computer was one of the higher-end Adaptec SCSI cards, which was very handy, a nice 16-bit Adaptec SCSI that could be used for internal drives, or it had an external connector as well. And occasionally I have found things, like I had an Apple II GS at one point before the Rifa cap decided to do its nasty madness. But inside that machine, there were a couple of rare boards. I think one of them was a SCSI board as well, which more on the rare side, and was very welcome to the person that I donated that computer to. When I got my PDP-11 and looked at the disk cartridges, there were some there was some software on there that was obviously business software that was written for the company that had used this PDP-11 in production. And that was kind of fascinating stuff, looking at how they coded old business applications. Mm-hmm. So, but I think that's probably the most interesting entries that I have. So, you know, nothing to write home about.
Huh. Yeah, I kind of wonder a little bit about business records and things. Those are sort of on the, somewhere in the edge between like the private letters and the installation of standard third-party business software. There's like, there could be interesting history in there, you know? So like I have business records of, you know, a furniture store, you know, that was using all of these software packages to keep track of things. And it's possible that, you know, that might be interesting to the people, to the, you know, the descendants of the people who ran the furniture store, you know, even if there's no tech person in the future that would find that useful. Or, you know, maybe it'll turn out that someone who later was famous worked at the furniture store earlier, or something like that, you know? Mm-hmm. So I am hoping that I will be able to do a little bit of an inventory of that kind of stuff too, you know, not just the applications, but also the data files. But again, you find yourself in kind of a weird situation where, like, I don't feel too bad looking at these myself, but I don't know to what extent they should ever be passed on to somebody once they coincidentally landed with me. So, yeah.
Well, I thought that, interestingly, there wasn't any data on the disk cartridges, only the programs. So I don't know where the data went, and that's probably a good thing. But the programs had the source code, and it was interesting kind of rifling through the source code and seeing how people used that particular language that they were using to write business applications that were custom for a particular business.
Yeah, and that's the kind of stuff where, you know, that really might exist only on that one disk you have, you know?
I think so.
It's interesting. You cast me back. I keep adding to this discussion here, but it's funny. I remember as a kid, I was, you know, 13, I think. This was, you know, in the mid-80s, and we moved to a house like early summer. And in the attic, it was a sizable house. It was an enormous attic. And in the attic, there's nothing except a life-size, sort of an aluminum, two-layer aluminum separated by some distance rendering of Colonel Sanders holding up his cane. And it was about this time that in the garage we found a like a 6 foot diameter wooden cutout of a chicken. And
now there's something you don't see every day.
Yeah, yeah. I wish I really wish I'd kept that. But at any rate, the other thing in the attic was this locked box, like a file box. And we finally got it open and realized that one of the family members who had lived in the house had run a Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise. And so there were a lot of records and, you know, printouts and tax items. But there were also 2 5-and-a-quarter-inch floppy disks that had they were a CAPRO labeled. So someone was using a CPM machine, you know, to keep some kind of records. And I wasn't, you know, I obviously wasn't collecting vintage machines because this was my Apple IIe was contemporary at the time. So, yeah, I you know, we just threw it away. But that would have been interesting to see, you know. To see what was on what had been on those discs. Your story reminded me.
Chicken records.
It was called Kentucky Fried Chicken back then. I think they had shifted to KFC for the healthy angle.
Oh yeah, I guess they had to get rid of the fried. In Montreal, it's PFK.
I think they might have gone back. I think they might have reverted to. I don't know. It's, yeah.
I haven't had that in forever. Man, that was tasty back in the day.
You're not wrong.
My memory is that it's good. I'm wondering if it actually is, but
just go with it. Yeah. Just don't ruin that childhood memory.
Right,
that's what I say. So, what do you think? Should we talk about feedback? Who's talking to us,
sir? So we got a few things I'll mention here. So a couple of things came in on Facebook, and maybe I will just add that if you are wanting to join us on the Facebook group, you are welcome to do so. We are interested and happy to have you there. When you join, it asks you a question. I don't know what there are some questions it asks you, something about like what counts as retro for you or something like that. Answer the questions just so that we know you're not a robot. So if you have asked to join and you haven't been approved, it might be just because we're not sure you're not a robot. So don't be a robot. Answer the questions.
That's what I always say.
Yeah. So let's see. So there was maybe just a couple of things. So on the Facebook group, Mike posted something saying that someone asked him about how to learn COBOL, and part of the reaction, actually, I guess I think he was reporting a sort of a secondhand interaction. But anyway, someone was asking someone else about how to learn COBOL, and part of the reaction was how that's silly because it's a dead language, and most of us sort of here know that it's current and relevant to some industries, but it brought up the question to Mike, like, are there any truly dead programming languages? And I thought that was sort of interesting. There was kind of an interesting comment thread that went through that. IBM JCL was floated as an idea. I barely know what that is. Job control language, I think it stands for, but some of the responses to that made it either casted as not a programming language actually, or still being used. Either one of those make it not count as dead.
I think Algol is dead.
Could be. Yeah, I think that came up in there somewhere.
Influential in the family of languages. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very influential, but I think dead in terms of does it see any modern use? I think it's on par with Latin.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a question too. Like, what counts as dead? I mean, like, does dead mean only retro computer enthusiasts use it? I mean, maybe. Mm-hmm. That might be it. Somebody suggested B. I barely even know what B is, but I think it's a predecessor to C.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was never sure if B was a predecessor to C, and I know it was connected with the Amiga's original operating system was written in BCPL. Do you know, Earl, is that the same as B, BCPL? I know it's a C-like.
I don't know.
Yeah, I know it's C-like and came before C, but these give off the little scent of something being dead. These questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think probably dead.
APL was also suggested, which I barely know what that is, but my understanding is that it requires a special keyboard and things to use it. And so I think
there were workarounds for that, but yeah, APL was a really interesting, you know, I'm sure that's one of the ones that Randy and I will wind up covering on Next Without Four, because such an interesting experiment in using symbols to do your programming as opposed to just standard written words. like you see in almost all other languages. And you're right, they did have special keyboards. Mm-hmm. At one of the vintage computer festivals, I saw what looked like an IBM PC or XT, but it had a keyboard that was designed with all the APL keys. It was just fascinating. It was a prototype. I don't know to what extent they actually sold those, but it just looked so foreign.
Yeah. I feel like it would take me a little while to be comfortable reading APL. Mm-hmm. APL stands for a programming language, right? Is that not correct?
I think that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Fairly delightful. But, yeah, other things that were suggested were Pascal and Ada, both, you know, rapidly shot down as being, you know, currently in use in various things, like COBOL, of course, Fortran, mm-hmm. and things like that.
I don't know if I'd call Pascal dead. I mean, you know, right. Learning language, but, and it's almost, you know, Visual, or I guess VBScript almost is a variant of Virtual Basic, basically is Pascal.
Yeah. Well, and Ada had so much government use, I would be super surprised mm-hmm. if there wasn't still a decent code base of Ada out there, mm-hmm. possibly even still being maintained at some level.
Right.
I think more dead than Pascal would be. I think the follow-up was Modula 2, which was designed to be, you know, more performant, but I think it saw far less use, you know, despite its you know, advantages as an actual language. You know, Pascal was learning. You can actually take that. Mm-hmm. I played with it 10 minutes.
Well, and Pascal was actually the, I think that was the fundamental interface to the original Mac toolbox,
yeah,
too, right?
The toolbox. The Apple IIgs and the Mac, I think, yeah, the APW, I think they had Pascal and also C. And there were several, like TML Pascal for the GS was the mm-hmm. easiest entry to build. Again, it's the same issue. It's toolbox. Basically the GS had the Mac toolbox. I just know more about it because I was on the GS at the time. But yeah,
right.
I think you're.
I guess part of what I was responding to there is that I think you know there were even real business applications for it, not mm-hmm. just learning, right?
Yes, I think Pascal. You're right.
I'd forgotten about that link with Pascal and the. Early days of the Macintosh. That's mm-hmm. right. Their set of books on programming the Macintosh mm-hmm. covered how you would interface with them in Pascal, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Man, that's...
Inside Macintosh, mm-hmm. Volume 1, 2, 3, 4.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think I had 4 and then like a 5 and 6 volume together or something like that. I forget, but... I think I had 1 to 3 together, and it was a like inch and a half thick... You know, big hardbound book. I wonder mm-hmm. if I still have that somewhere, probably.
That's interesting. I have a few of the Apple IIgs equivalents, toolbox, mm-hmm. you know, equivalents. But another thing I'll say about Pascal, I know as someone who was very much a fan of the demo scene in the Amiga, and I still am, but in the Amiga mm-hmm. days in the late 80s. Early 90s, and then when I shifted to DOS in the same period, a lot of the, you know, you'd read the comments about, you know, the little about file, you know, fileinfo.diz or whatever it was, and they would, most of the demos, or a great many of them, were written in Pascal as far as setting up a little framework, a launching point to then dive into the assembly routines, which... You know, necessarily controlled the impressive time critical parts, but rather than use, you know, C, because it really didn't matter when you're, you know, kind of housekeeping Pascal to, you know, Turbo Pascal or, you know, Borland Pascal was very frequently cited, much more frequently than C in my experience, as far as, you know, what was kind of the wrapper. Yeah, it's. Whenever it was doing anything real, it was some really artful assembly. That was what made it so astounding to look at some of those productions. Yeah.
Well, I think just a cautionary note, if you're going to invent a new computer language, just know that, you know, if you're sitting there thinking, this will be good for 5 or 10 years, it might live a lot longer than that. When we're having to scratch our heads and really dig deep to figure out which computer languages have authentically died, you know that everything in the computer world lives longer than you think it's going to.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sort of like the XKCD about standards, right?
I haven't seen that one. Oh, I want to.
It's findable, but it's often brought into discussions of this nature, where essentially the problem being that we have too many standards, so we should you know sort of try to encompass them all into one, and now we have too many plus one.
That's right. Yeah. You have to love XKCD.
Yeah. Andrew on Facebook posted a T-shirt mock-up that he did. There's actually a couple of things here that it's slightly too bad that Carrington isn't here, because they're sort of directed at him. But apparently, Carrington and Mike McGinnis back on an old episode of No Quarter were talking about, I don't know, I think it was like sort of sexism in games and things like that, and what is the marked and unmarked character. But they talked about the possibility of there being a Pac-Woman game and a Mr. Pac-Woman. He mocked up a pretty cool T-shirt, you know, where it was like Pac-Woman was just like the regular sort of like pie-shaped yellow thing, and Mr. Pac-Woman had this like weird monocle and top hat and stuff.
I love things like that make you think.
It's pretty cool. But anyway, so if you go to our Facebook page, answer the questions, and then look through the scroll, you can see that. Ben wrote on email a couple of things about one of the previous episodes about the readers. We mentioned that the Kindle, like that somebody had a concern about the Kindle and whether you own the stuff that's on the Kindle and stuff. And Carrington had kind of talked about running them through. I always pronounced it as Calibre, but maybe it is Caliber. I don't know. Anyway, this program that you can use to kind of keep things together. But I did remember this correctly. There was a book that was removed from everybody's Kindle. And it turned out that the book that was removed was Orwell's 1984, which is also sort of somehow
hugely ironic.
Ironic, yeah. Curious.
Yeah. And so Calibre is, Ben says, it's ugly enough to be a Java app. Indeed. But it's actually written mainly in Python. And in fact, it's not only written in Python, it's written in Python 2, and the developer has no plans at all to move it to Python 3. saying there's a sort of some bug report kind of discussion that suggests that what the developer said basically, I'd be better off maintaining Python 2 than trying to shift this code base. So
that's good.
Anyway, it's pretty funny. Yeah. Let's see. I think I'll leave.
Again, with the things that last longer than you think they're going to, Python 2 definitely falls into that category.
Right. Yeah. And then I guess the last one I'll mention, I didn't have very much to say about this really, but Tony over email pointed us to an article in Nuts and Volts on the TRS-80 Model 1. So we'll have a link to that. It actually... When I first went to look at this, I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. I still think it's kind of cool. But it's actually, I think it's from, given the how long ago the comments are, I think it's actually from like 5 years ago or something. So it's not a particularly recent article. But Nuts and Bolts actually still exists as a sort of going concern. There is a digital edition. It is a magazine. And it's actually sort of interesting. I've subscribed to it for... I've subscribed to it for probably 2 years, and I've read probably 3 articles. But I keep collecting them and putting them somewhere, thinking I will read them at some point. But they have occasionally had some kind of interesting little articles about, like, so I remember that there was one. I'm not sure if I'm gonna be able to find it by searching for it, but there was one about adding color to your pet, and things like that. They have some kind of neat vintage computing articles, as well as sort of like modern articles about, you know, just using microcontrollers and that kind of stuff. So it might be worth checking that out to see if you are interested. If you are interested in retro things, of course you are. You're listening to this, and also interested in, you know, sort of modern microcontroller maker type stuff. It looks like they do have a pretty interesting magazine going there. But so that was part of what made me think about mentioning that feedback. It's just that not only did they have an article 5 years ago about the TRS-80 Model 1, but they as a sort of publication are pretty interesting. So do you guys know Nuts and Bolts at all? Is that familiar to either of you?
Okay. Yeah, I haven't. I've seen it on a shelf, and I see it on eBay, but I have never actually read, gone through it.
I've read a couple of linked articles through the years, and they seemed interesting. It wasn't on retro stuff, though. It was on more modern electronics, the other things you were mentioning just a second ago, with the microcontrollers and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think they came to my attention because at least for a brief time, it looked like they were going to have kind of like a retro column. I'm not remembering much of the details now, but they definitely had an article about like taking your Commodore PET and adding a color circuit to it.
Did you happen to say what year it had started? Do you recall, or did you not mention? Do you know?
I'm sure I didn't mention it because I do not know. This article was from 5 years ago, so it must have been 5 years at least.
Yeah. I think they've been around for quite a while.
Yeah, I think they came to my attention only because of this PET article, but I know that they had a couple since then. You know, it looked like this was a place where there was going to be a regular column, and maybe there even is, because I really don't look at this. I just keep collecting the issues every month and think someday I'm going to look at this. So anyway, I think that'll do for the feedback for now. So
I'm just curious, if I altered the PET so it had color, that would mean, though, that I'd have to run an external monitor, because the built-in monitor is monochrome.
True.
Yeah. Hmm.
Well, anyway, I won't belabor that. Maybe I'll look at the article. I'll go find that.
Yeah, somewhere we definitely have it linked. I'm actually searching around now to try to find it. But
Well, while you do that, why don't we jump over to items of interest?
Sure.
Blake, you have the first one on Total Replay.
So, Total Replay, which I guess has been pretty big news for any Apple II fan out there. It's just overall a collection. 4AM and Qcomba to work together to put together a complete, it's a great many. I think it started out as 200 or so games that had been cleanly deprotected. There were no crack screens. Moved to a ProDOS, moved from their DOS 3.3 origins to a ProDOS volume, which at times required editing of the save routines, clearly. And it has a nice attract mode, a nice interface menu. It shows previews of games in play, and it taps into if you have a VidHD item, it'll actually show you Apple IIgs super high-res graphic versions of the scans of the box art of some of the games. It's pretty amazing. It supports everything from an Apple II, I believe, on up. So just to give a recap for those that might not be aware of what it is, a pretty big update happened a few days ago. It's version 4.0 alpha.3. And there's been some improvements to, there's performance in some areas, the VidHD support, but they've added, I believe, 110 additional games, which is a huge number. And a lot of them are really big titles, Archon, Arctic Fox, so just going down the list. It's a long list. So now it's still within the 32 megabyte volume, so you can mount it with a CFFA 3000, with a, I guess a floppy EMU will mount that. Am I correct? Okay.
I think that's correct.
Yeah, and it looks like a micro drive, a booty, and a W drive. I'm not highly familiar with all of these, but yes, you can mount it and boot and have fun with that. But it's just a major update that involves adds a great many new titles, and it's one of the best things I think you can boot up on your Apple II right now. Mm-hmm. So impressive work.
I can say that it definitely works on a floppy EMU now that I think about it, because as I look to my left, that's what I have my Apple IIc Plus set up as.
I see it's the ones I listed now after you mentioned that were actually listed on the archive.org info page, so it supports all those devices. Yeah.
Yeah. I have that's pretty much how my Apple IIc Plus is set up, by default. And I have a floppy EMU connected to it, and I just basically turn it on and Total Replay starts. And if I want to do something else, I'll do something else. But odds are whatever I want to do is on Total Replay.
Right. It has that nice attract mode, and it you set it there, and it doesn't just show you screenshots. Like, it'll leap right into a game in play. So clearly they've snapshot somehow, a memory state able to just you know, snap, we've shifted over, and here's a game in play. It was a pleasure to, you know, when this new version came out with the 110 additional games, I just turned it on my, you know, 2E to my left, you know, as I'm working during the workday, and like that was introducing me. I look over, oh, look at that. That'll be fun to play tonight, you know, and it's 110 extra things. It's crazy. Hard to overstate the greatness of this thing.
Yeah, yeah. And it's got a really pretty nice interface too, in that it has a sort of like modernish smart search too, in a way. Mm-hmm. Like, so you can start typing a couple of characters of the game that you're looking for, and it will go there, you know. So it's pretty easy to find. If you know what's there, then it's pretty easy to jump straight there. Some of this, at least I like the launching screen has this nice sort of collage of a bunch of little characters from the various games, which can remind you, oh yeah, I wanted to play Sneakers or whatever. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I'll say that it's basically one of the driving forces for me to finally make the purchase. I was one of the beta testers for the hardware of the VidHD device. So I still have the beta device, which is, I've been quite enjoying as far as, you know, using clear text on a second screen and, you know, this and that. But it lacks the, you know, the firmware and the final, it's not detectable by software. So I can't, you know, see the extra magic from Total Replay as well as some of the other things. And of course, I want to support John Brooks, you know, so if I'm finally going to, you know, purchase an actual release version, and then I can't wait to then see the, you know, on my 2E, see the scanned in box art. And I believe you could actually program a super high res, you know, application that tapped into that mode on a 2E or a 2 Plus or a 2 using the VidHD hardware, if I'm not mistaken. So yeah, the whole thing is a nice setup.
Yeah, I think that's true. I haven't followed that too closely, but I think that is correct, that if so the way the VidHD works is it basically just sort of watches over all the writes and stuff that happen on the address bus, basically.
The bus,
so
yeah.
So it's not, it's sort of parasitic. It's just observing and replicating stuff in its own brain. And so it doesn't know that your computer, I mean, like it might know what computer you have or whatever, but it doesn't need to be conscious of the fact that your computer doesn't have a super high res mode. If you can hit all the right address things, even if they don't do anything in your actual computer, you can make the VidHD display these, you know, super high res images.
Right. So. Right. And I think, and again, I don't know the full capabilities, but John was, I texted a question to, John Brooks, the creator, tweeted the other night. And yeah, he pointed out with the firmware, and again, I don't know how directly you can access this, but you can now detect the VidHD. Like a program can say, okay, we have it here, you know, so I'm going to start doing this. And I don't know if there are, you know, connection points to, you know, drive it directly, or yeah, if it's, as you say, you're, you know, as long as you go through the motions, it should set itself up thinking that you're, you know, actually accessing hardware that isn't there. So. Yeah, it's kind of an amazing piece of hardware. It's an amazing device, and I'll say, it's only, you know, it's amazingly inexpensive. Like, I think it's $120 or something like that. It's shocking, and it's still available. So if you don't have one, you know, go get it, because it's not going to always be available.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they work in basically all of the Apple IIs that have slots.
Including the GS. The GS, so you can get certain advantages with that. Yes, the GS has that resolution, but of course you can hook the external, you know, HDMI, and then it also has, you know, different modes as far as, you know, how you want the output to look. It's great.
As far as I know, it doesn't do anything in the Apple III. So that's it.
Oh, okay.
I was curious about that because the Apple II and Apple III have electrically compatible slots. So a lot of times the Apple II card will work in the Apple III, but this one is. This one is looking so carefully at how the video memory works, and the Apple III is a different video architecture. Though, I mean, the 2GS does too, so I suppose it's possible. I wonder how much space there is in the firmware. Anyway, thinking idly.
Well, Paul, did you find what you were looking for?
I think I did, now that you mention it. The thing I was looking for was stuff about the color PET.
Oh, right. And how do they work that when the PET has a monochrome display?
Right. So I went to the nuts and bolts site and found, you know, that there is a vintage computing column, and this is I think this was even the cover story. It was adding color to the Commodore PET, September 2015. Yeah. And so there's just an article about this. I don't know. Let's see. So the question that Earl that you had about was basically what do you do about the monitor?
It looked like they were showing it with an external. When you scrolled over there, you see over on the right.
Yeah. 1084.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that does seem to be what's happening, is that they have a way to drive an external monitor, perhaps while leaving the monochrome one internal on as well. So
fine.
I've brought up on the screen the cover of it, and it's the cover is in fact of the color PET.
So this image you don't see very often.
Yep.
So I'd switched over to the comments for just a second, and I wanted to answer Curtis. He said he is just joining in and wondered if we covered all retro or just specific systems, and we are all retro. All retro, all the time, 24/7 retro heaven.
Equal opportunity vintage.
Yeah, we even try to cover as best we can systems that weren't U.S.-based. And we do have a couple of our correspondents that are international. Carrington in Canada, Michael in Australia, Jack in Sweden. So, yep. Mm-hmm. If it's retro, we're here. Speaking of which, the next news story, I think I'm up. I wanted to talk for just a second about Septandi. Have you guys heard of this?
I haven't.
No, I have not.
So this is kind of... as I understand it, a celebration of all things Tandy computing on YouTube. So if you go to YouTube and look for Septandy, if you search for that, or if you go to Twitter and search for the hashtag Septandy, you'll find a bunch of retro YouTubers making videos on various Tandy computers. And I think it can be any of the Tandy lines. So it could be the Model 100. It could be the Model 1, 2, 3, 4. Could be the Coco. One that I saw was on a really nice retrobriting and restoration of a Coco 3. And it, you know, the computer went into the process, honestly, not looking so great, and came out of the process looking really nice, no longer yellowed. The keys look great. And so the computer itself worked. So this was just more of a cosmetic facelift than it was a repair video. But anyway, variety of things out there. And I'm not sure how it got started with September in Tandy, but it doesn't matter because it's fun and I like it.
It's nice to have a place to put your projects. I mean, like, you know, you kind of know if you're working on one of these projects, if you post it under this topic, then other people will see it. You know, you don't have to sort of specifically advertise it. You can just hashtag it.
Mm-hmm. It'll get more visibility, and the Tandy community at large can have fun for the month of September. So it looks like, Paul, you had the next one.
Yeah, so the next thing, this is not, I mean, it's musings of my own partly, but so this is a little thing that was just sort of people were discussing in the, in a Apple II oriented Slack workspace. So this is Kelvin Sherlock's little, basically it's a front end to MAME. On a Mac, but it's basically just you pick, you know, which of the Apple machines you want. You can have Apple One, Apple Two, Apple IIe, GS, Apple III, and it basically will just create for you the command line that you use to launch the MAME emulator for these machines. And the thing is that MAME is, you know, very, it has a lot of capability, and people have worked very hard to make it, you know, very accurate as far as like the emulation goes, but it's not easy to get into from a user interface perspective. I mean, a lot of it is really launching with 15 different command line options, and it launches into its own little window. There's not much user interface at all.
Very much agree.
Yeah. So it's great, but it's slightly inaccessible. I've used it a fair amount because it's the only kind of functioning Apple III emulator that there is. So, so I've got a command line that I paste out of a document and just use. But what this, so this is called Ample. And it's basically just a front end window. You set the options and then you hit launch. It has the ability to, you can set what all the different cards are in the different slots in the computer. You can mount images. You can kind of drag them from drive two to drive one and so forth. And, actually another thing that's kind of neat about it is that if you, it sort of will auto install everything for you in a sense. So you download this, it gives you the sort of like most current as of the time this was built, MAME installation. And then there's a nice little interface window that will go and retrieve, if it can't find the ROMs on your computer, it will go look on archive.org for them. So it is a good, it has a good sort of like workaround for the fact that you don't want to distribute the ROMs, but you kind of need the ROMs in order to make this functional.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it's and that part is actually one of the neatest things about this, that it just will sort of bring everything in. So it makes this very close to a one-click usable solution for things that other than the Apple III. Like we had the Apple III ready to run package for basically just trying to get the Apple III emulation working, and this and that was by somebody else. This is basically just a way to make it possible to set up all of the kind of like. This is designed for the Apple-based things. I think if you wanted to try to extend this, it's Mac only as far as running the front end, but it's a neat idea, and I think it's going to be useful for people who want to get into MAME but haven't wanted to get past that first barrier.
I'll say that's I bumped into that mm-hmm. when I tried to use MAME. I found it to be like you say. It had coverage of an amazing number of computers, mm-hmm. And they had worked very hard on the accuracy. It just wasn't that approachable. I would bump into this roadblock and that roadblock and kind of gave up after a while. So something like this is really exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I agree. I've had different front ends and, a big part of it is, getting the ROMs that are needed in the right place, but it's, if you're trying to enable this or that feature, some of the interfaces have all of the parts, some don't. And then one thing that I keep running into is ROM version issues. There would be, this MAME version needs this set of ROM pulls. And I guess it sounds like maybe the archive.org interface will, given that it's, this has recently come out and it's looking at the current state of archive.org, maybe that's not a roadblock, maybe it's around that. So that sounds pretty nice, pretty appealing.
Yeah. I think this is nice. This will be nice for being able to point someone to this emulator and say and of course I am most interested in the Apple III in a way because this is the only option. And so I really like that. But the other thing that I thought was neat about this was that there's this sort of a second pane called AV, which exposes a couple of options that let you record the output of the emulator session. The thing I wanted to mention about that was that MAME had this. This isn't Ample's doing. Ample's really just a front end, just launching MAME. But I didn't know MAME could do this until I mm-hmm. saw it as an option. This is also a way to kind of keep up with MAME without having to keep up with MAME.
I wasn't aware it had streaming / recording either.
Yeah. I didn't know that either.
It records in the most raw version possible. The files are very large, but I did a short 1 minute playing Missile Command on the Apple III or whatever, and it was a gigabyte and a half or something video file. But it looked good. So.
Wow. Yeah, and you can always post process it, but
right.
It is pretty huge, actually.
Yeah, it came down to when I did post process it, it was a 13 megabyte file. So,
well, Blake, you have the next one. Something about crashing and burning. You're not talking about us, are you?
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
There's a blog I ran across, and I can't recall if I've mentioned this in one of the recent shows, but I discovered a blog called The Dork Web, which is a cute name. But it has some very, it's run by a guy named Steve Lord. Very well done. Very deep history in some of the articles. And so I'd encourage people to check out the overall blog. But Crash and Burn, an Amiga ST story, it tells the basically, you know, it's a history that's been told a number of times, but it, you know, takes its own particular look at, you know, how the Amiga computer, you know, which started out, it was going to be an Atari computer, as far as, you know, investments, where money came from. I ended up on the Amiga side, and it's a nice account that goes into the history of, you know, some of the events, some of the shows that the Amiga was demonstrated at. There's some anecdotes from some of the developers. They go into, there's a nice little piece that he's pulled together talking about the creation of the famous bouncing ball demo. Yeah, it's a great additional look at the Amiga's history, and it has some, you know, a little bit of depth in areas that some of the others don't. It's certainly worth a read if you have any interest, you know, in the history of Commodore or Atari or the Amiga specifically. I just thought it was well put together, and there's lots of videos linked. So yeah, definitely a nice way to spend a little time. Looking at some details that you might not have known before in that history.
Yeah, this looks quite deep. I mean, like, yeah, it's very long.
Yes. It goes into, I think, the pulling together, just the pulling together of some of these videos as far as, you know, how they might interact through a timeline is a valuable thing. But, you know, the article itself, aside from that, has a great deal of depth, talking about, you know, unreleased systems, Atari 260 STD, not the best name, really.
No, I was just thinking that.
you don't want to, that one was prone to viruses, so it never really made it out the door, yeah. But, sorry about that. Anyway, yeah, it's a great read, and this is some of the old Commodore ads, the discussion of their effectiveness, some of the, you know, Will Shatner talking about some of the spokesmen. It's a nice piece, and, you know, it gives you a glimpse of, kind of the quality of this blog that I recently discovered and, you know, had tweeted about. So, have a look. It's a nice one. Worth a read.
Excellent. Yeah, I'll be excited to read this article and look at some of the videos. That whole thing was such a soap opera Clash of the Titans thing, with Trammell leaving Commodore and then buying up Atari and those two going head-to-head on the new 16-bit world. It's just such a interesting historical, just such an interesting time in computing history.
Right. I mean, and it was, you know, it was sort of, as you say, it was like two... kind of a head-to-head battle, you know. Trammell is going to counter the Amiga, and he actually, you know, brought the ST out first. You know, it actually got to market before the Amiga. You know, the systems have some differences, but they certainly both were notable. And it was quite a time. And it's also the kind of the fading of Commodore, Irving Gould, and, you know, kind of how the finances and the handling of these things were. Sort of a sad end to what might have been.
How to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory.
Yes, very much so. And I can't recall it. I'm looking. It takes so long to scroll to the end of this informative article that my fingers are hurting. So, but no, it doesn't look. I was wondering if the video is included. There's that video. I can't remember which of the fellas took it, but, you know, walking through the last day of Commodore, you know, the day that they...
Oh, the deathbed vigil.
The deathbed vigil, yes. Like, hey, we're closed, and, you know, you see engineers still working because they don't know what else to do. You know, it's like, well, you're not being paid anymore, so, sad. But, you know, that's all part of the history of how computing got to where it is, and certainly a colorful bit of that. So, yeah, I was very happy to run across this article.
Awesome. Well, Paul, you have something about Doug Engelbart?
Yep. And this is pretty quick, partly because I haven't done, you know, the relevant homework. So on our Facebook page, Thomas posted a link to a documentary called The Augmentation of Douglas Engelbart. And this is, it's an hour long documentary, and it looks quite professional. Basically just sort of, it's you know, a documentary on Douglas Engelbart. The whole thing is there. It's produced by the Silvera brothers. And the reason I wanted to point that out is just that it is on their official YouTube channel. So this is not someone pirating their movie and making it available. This is, they have made it available. If you wanted to, you can pay Amazon to watch it. But so it's possible that there is a way to support it. In any event, you have the ability to watch it. It's from last year, so it's not it's basically pretty new, 2019, and it looks really interesting. I don't know more about it than that, but I think it'd be worth taking a look. Douglas Engelbart is the one from the mother of all demos that demoed the mouse and all these sort of like hypertext ideas and things. Mm-hmm. Here's the corded keyboard. I'm looking forward to watching it. I have not watched it at all. I've sort of skimmed through bits of it to see that it is really professionally put together. So, do either of you know this prior to this mention?
Know of that movie? Documentary? No. And that's going to be definitely on my watch list.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm certainly familiar with the mother of all demos and Engelbart's history, but I hadn't seen this. I know they had. I'm very anxious. Now that I know about it, I'll certainly check it out. I was happy to see that some of the hardware. I believe the corded keyboard, and I know the mouse, the wooden mouse with the two metal disc wheels tied to potentiometers, were conveniently on display at the Museum of American History in DC, which is a quick run for me, and I've taken a look at those on the other side of the glass a few times, which was quite nice. I want to check it out. I had not heard of that.
Some of the history that I was familiar with from that time period was just from the book What the Dormouse Said, How the 60s Counterculture Shaped the Personal Computer Industry. It was kind of fascinating to find out that the artifacts you were just talking about, like, you know, all of that work is interesting from a technological standpoint, but it was also interesting from the goal that they had, which was at Stanford there to augment human intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I guess there were two groups. There was the one for artificial intelligence, and there was the other group with Engelbart for augmenting human intelligence through creative application of technology. And just so interesting. So yeah, definitely. I may actually tune into this like when we hang up.
You hear it in different places when you hear Engelbart mentioned, you know, he's the guy who invented the mouse. It's like, well, it's not really, you know, that it was a detail along the way, but that really wasn't, you know, that wasn't really the point. It was much bigger than that. I remember when Apple came out with the mouse for the Apple II, there was A+ magazine, which was, you know, quite a popular publication for Apple II and Mac people, had Engelbart on the cover, peeking over a table, looking at an actual mouse, and then Apple's 2C with a mouse next to it. And they talked about the mouse and a bit of his overall role, but it was more about the mouse, which was, I guess, made sense in that context.
Well, and I guess finally, on our news and items of interest, we have some sad news to report.
Yeah, it's sad to hear, and there's been a lot of response to this online. Atari historian Kurt Vendel passed away at the age of 53, and he was a very prominent Atari historian. Yeah, he was big in the retro computing scene. I'll say up front, I'm not, I haven't moved heavily in the Atari circles, not as much as some of the others, and so unfortunately, I never really interacted with Curtis. And, you know, I can't say that I really knew him, but it's impressive to see, you know, the collections, some of the, he wrote a book, Atari Inc. Business is Fun. And just interesting to hear what I have so far, of his history. He founded the Atari History Museum, which has, you know, tens of thousands of, documents and, different schematics, artwork, lithographs of the boards, from Atari. So it sounds like he certainly is someone that's going to be very much missed, for those that have followed the history of Atari. And apparently he was a very, very pleasant fellow to know. So, again, I didn't personally know him, but I've seen quite an outpouring of, response on the social networks to this. So I don't know if either of you two were closer with Curtis.
I never had the opportunity, personally. Yeah. But some of the folks that are friends of mine in the retro computer community knew him quite well and were shaken by his loss.
Yeah, I see on IRC, people throughout the past few days, I can see a couple of mentions here in the window right now, as the people have come in and out, you know, talking about it. And I think I became aware when Jason Scott did a tweet talking about it. So, yeah, it's sad to hear. Obviously, that's a little bit younger than you'd want to, you know, mm-hmm. than you'd want to see someone pass. But yeah.
And I believe Jason Scott has an interview that he did with him as well, that I haven't watched it, but it was recently posted. I mean, like, it will be findable. I think it might have been in the context of the BBS documentary. I'm not quite sure exactly what the context was that the interview was done. But yeah, there was I believe there was a couple of these books. You know, so Business is Fun and Business is War or something like that. I'm not sure exactly. There may have been a trilogy in planned. I'm not exactly sure what the story was with those. But there are a few. So. Atari Inc. Business is Fun, Atari Corporation Business is War, I think were the first two, and I'm not sure if the second one actually got finished.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sad to have not had the opportunity to know more now's a time for me to get familiar, of course, but it would not have been nice. It would have been nice to have known him, even if just online.
Yeah.
So. But yeah, it seems like we can't get put so many months along without a little more sad news of this sort. And I guess that's how it works. But yeah.
That's true. Although at 53, he was gone too soon. Well, I think that wraps up the news and items of interest. So now a word from our sponsor.
Radio Shack puts the power of business computing in your home and saves you $300. The powerful 286 Tandy 1000, now only $1,199, including color monitor. You save $300. It's PC compatible, easy to use, comes with 7 ready-to-run programs for the family to keep a budget, write term papers, or even do filing and create graphics. Complete Tandy 1000 system with color monitor, only $1,199. Only at Radio Shack.
And we're back already. And so we can talk about this episode's host gift idea, which is a book. And this particular book will help you if you want to make your own games for the Atari 2600. And the person who wrote this book also has a website called 8-Bit Workshop, which in and of itself is amazing. This author, Stephen Hugg, also has a variety of other books, including one that will help you if you want to create computer gaming sort of things with FPGA. So I just thought this book would be a pretty good general interest kind of choice. But just to let you know, this the author has other offerings and other projects going, and I believe, Paul, didn't we see him in Kansas Fest?
Yes. Yes, there was he did a presentation on this 8-bit workshop environment as well at Kansas Fest. It's I think we can probably find a link to that presentation that we can put in the show notes. But it was really, he went through the various things that this 8bitworkshop.com development environment can do. And he did it very, very fast. Like it was remarkable. It was a remarkably smooth and fast presentation. And I don't know how he can move Windows around that fast, but it was live, I believe. I mean, I don't think it was pre-recorded, but it was just a sight to behold, even if you weren't interested in the 8-bit workshop.
Although I am interested in the 8-bit workshop, and also I've always been fascinated with the idea of making a homebrew game for the 2600. The 2600 has such a small amount of built-in smarts that you really, as the programmer, you're working in a constrained amount of space as well. So it seems like the ultimate in, if you want to really hone your skills and practice some minimalism, it seems like an exciting and fun thing to do.
It's another testament of a theme that which keeps coming up, the development process for a 2600 game, which has just a few bits of memory, is a testament to just how expensive and rare, RAM was. You're literally, as the book title says, you're chasing the beam. You're basically dealing with a scan line. It's funny. Nowadays, we can buy, I recently, for a little bit less than $80, bought 16 gigabytes of memory. And, it's... But these were the difference between, 256 bytes or 1,024 bytes. That's a big difference in price. And, there were some heroes that were made in the creation of Atari 2600 games, I think, as far as development savvy.
That's true. So that's my idea, and it's pretty inexpensive. I like to pick...
That's a good one.
...cheaper things for my gift ideas. Last time... I think I picked the Altair Arduino, which was a little more expensive, but still super fun. Mm-hmm. But this time I thought I'd try and find a budget item.
Okay. Excellent. That's a fun one. That's a fun one.
And you should save some money because you're going to want to buy all the eBay things we're about to talk about.
That's right.
So, Blake, why don't you kick us off? What have you got?
Okay. Let's see. First up for me... is the, Vintage Olympia EX100 Typewriter Extension CPM Computer Word Processor Systel. And what that is, it's a standalone CPM computer, which includes a word processor, but apparently can run other applications. It has a disk drive. And the interesting thing is it requires, there's a typewriter, a smart typewriter, which is the electronic keyboard and its integrated printer. You use that as the keyboard input mechanism for this computer. So if you have a typewriter, a particular one that will interface with this, and I'm trying to see what, it requires I actually can't see which typewriter requires, but it requires a similar branded typewriter that'll let you turn it into a CPM computer. And the thing that I guess first got my attention, I mean, it's a novel concept, but what grabbed me first, and we talked recently about design, I think of the last show, is just the design of this thing. It looks like something you'd see in, 2001 or something, on board the space station. It's, it looks like a single unit. It's, there's the main body. It's looks snow white with a minimal, 5 1/4 inch drive. And there's a post, which presumably has a rotating mechanism. And on top of it sits the green CRT. So it looks very futuristic, to me, or at least what we thought futuristic things would look like long ago.
And as Carrington would say, you got to watch out because photos can lie, but it really does look like it hasn't yellowed.
It looks snow white to me. Like, it's kind of amazing. It really does look white, and that kind of lends the futuristic, that sterile shape and look. It's the cost is $1,499. I'd never heard of this before. I'd never seen this before, but it's an interesting looking device, and it's novel in its method of operation. So unfortunately, shipping to me from Texas is $250. So it's kind of steep. And
they have a make offer.
It does have a make offer. So
there's a little bit of that same kind of effect that you get with the, I guess it's the iMac G4, but you know, the little lampshade iMac. This is it's a body with a neck and a head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I kind of like the 5 1/4 inch disk drive. There's a very, you know, 90-degree. Made of 90 degrees, just a slot with the larger middle piece for the door that shuts. But it's you know, perfectly black inside there, and it's perfectly white on the outside. So it's a very contrasty thing. Yeah, it's interesting. It looks nifty, I think.
I'm wondering if it might be painted, because it does seem like there's just no way it could be that color. And it's up against what must be white sheets. So if they were really trying to do a color deception, you know, they must have found yellow sheets to put it on, right? So I think it must actually be white.
Maybe so. It has a low serial number, if that is of any matter to anyone. Yeah. They don't show it with a typewriter. They're not offering that I see a typewriter that connects. I'm sure if someone was bent on it, they could interface a keyboard to it with an FPGA, but I'm not sure how valuable this is to someone out there. But it looks like there's some little controls under the front. There's the power switch, but I can't quite make out I guess it's just a reset button. And so anyway, I thought it was interesting in a couple of different ways. So that was my first. Mm-hmm. My second item is, and this, I just bring this up because I've seen these over the years, having used an Atari ST on and off at different times in the past, and I was aware of the fact that at one point Atari started creating PC clones, you know, generic PC clones, and it's what we have here is an Atari PC 4, which has a 802.86. It's not special in any particular way. It has a, you know, integrated, has a hard drive sitting in the half-height bay. But it is interesting, you know, at a time when Atari was, the 8-bits were sort of in the past, the ST and the Jaguar were something that they were, you know, doing. But Atari and Commodore both got on board the Commodore cult got on board the, you know, we need to make PC clones because people buy PC clones. And it's just an interesting little piece of the history of both of those companies, I think, that they put, you know, time and effort. And I think Atari, the thing that got me with this is I've always actually thought that the design was pretty interesting. It's not as bland or boring as you might think. It's a system with an angular foot in the front, and, you know, it has a 90-degree kind of severely cut drive and status light recesses. I always thought it looked a little, you know, futuristic, not unlike some of the IBM PS2 and IBM's RS6000 workstation aesthetics, but I like the look of it much more than the Commodore systems. And it's just interesting, you know, here's a time when these guys, you know, felt it was, they just needed to put some effort into this, because whoever's going to buy an ST, you know that people are going to buy a PC clone. So it's sort of interesting what it represents. And anyway, it's this one, $799 with a buy it now, and it has a make it offer. It seems a little bit high to me, maybe. I don't know as far as how collectible these are. I don't feel like I see a lot of these on eBay. You know, it's pretty bog standard, you know, 286. It's not bringing anything particularly special, but there it is. I remember seeing these, you know, when I was using the ST and taking note.
I was always kind of curious what target market they were going with these. I wish I could talk to somebody that worked at those companies in that day and age, you know, either Atari or Commodore in the PC clone world, because why would I buy one from them?
It seems like they were, like, Atari had so much trouble. If you look into the history, they had so much trouble determining, okay, do we push the ST and the Falcon hard? No, we're going to shift to this, you know, the Jaguar gaming console, you know, like, and they shifted all their dice to this console that did not do well. You know, so, like, in the middle of these decisions, it seems like a PC clone, like, and again, Commodore did this too. Maybe the thought was, well, you know, people are buying, like, our market share is, you know, 2% or 3%, but, you know, the PC market share is, you know, 88% or, you know, so what are the odds that someone's not going to buy a few of these machines, you know? But it seems like it had to have depleted the effort that could have gone into, you know, making some of the other systems, you know, better, or at least having the time to juggle, you know, maybe their product line, their core product line, better. So it seems a distraction, but also it seems like sort of they were trying to throw them, give themselves a lifeline as a backup. Do either of you agree with that, or?
Sounds like it could be true. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like I've seen this before, but, you know, it's quite possible that it just sort of operates in a world I don't look at. But it does look pretty cool, though. I do kind of like that foot.
Yeah, it's severe. It has a severe design. And I guess it also looks quite white. Atari was more white and gray. I don't think they had a lot of beige not since the 800 and the 400. It looks more white than you'd think it does. Kind of like the last one as far as the white portion. But again, shipping on this one is a little bit high, 121. Well, maybe for a PC. There's no monitor. Actually, there is a monitor included, isn't there?
There's a monitor I'm pictured. I'm not sure. Or at least there's some screenshots pictured to show that it works.
And the monitor on it is an Atari. I can just slightly see the top of the... no monitor is included.
Okay.
But it looks like an Atari ST monitor is attached, and he's showing that they're showing it works. You can just see the tip of the A in that blue. Okay. So I think I have one last item. And this, again, sort of the aesthetics of this one are what brought me to it. It's sort of the time frame and how those two seem to collide in my mind. This is a IBM 9331-011 8-inch external floppy drive, but it looks like it is definitely well into the PS2 design period, as far as, you know, the blue color used on the latch that's shown on the front. It looks like a modern looking drive, and I never would have guessed it was 8 inches. It seems to have the overall height and width as far as aspect ratio. Looks like a standard 5 1/4-inch drive, but it seems odd to me that an 8-inch drive would have so modern an aesthetic as far as what we know of, you know, IBM's design cycle. This doesn't look anything like a PC or an AT. This clearly, you know, is after the PS2. Does that seem a little bit anachronistic to either of you as well?
Yes, and I totally agree with you about the PS2 aesthetic, especially on the badge. If you look at it, it's got that kind of diagonal IBM angular logo. Fascinating.
Yeah, it seems strange. You know, looking online, I've seen a couple of other places, you know, mentioning this, but I was having trouble finding a year, you know, that an actual release year. And of course, most of the links point back to this auction. But but it's interestingly, there's a similar looking external drive that is somewhat similar looking, that is 5 1/4-inch black, same color, and they're saying it's for the AS400, which is one of their minis. So it could be that, you know, this was not something that was even meant to use with the PS2, and the black might be telling that that it's more of a, you know, whatever.
Do they show the connectors on the pictures?
It's just this one photo.
Oh, it's just the one photo.
Okay.
And let's see. I'm going to send a link, oddly, from Walmart.com.
Yeah, that's cool.
Walmart is where you can buy your 5 1/4 inch AS400 drive if you need to. Sam Wall was big into the IBM minis. But so you see, this has an aesthetic similarity. And actually, looking at this next to the 8-inch, I bet that's the same size enclosure. You see how small the 5 1/4 inch drive is. This is a 5 1/4 inch drive, whereas the other one was 8-inch. And it sort of gives some size, kind of a size cue to the other device's case.
That's interesting.
Which I think might be the same case with a different front.
Yeah. Because you know, when your actual auction came up before, I didn't realize until you said that it was an 8-inch drive that it was an 8-inch drive. I mean, I assumed it was a 3.5-inch drive because it really just is proportioned like one. But this one does, you know, now that we're looking at the 5 1/4-inch drive in what appears to be an 8-inch case, then.
And, I know the AS400, and I'm not surprised that they're saying this is designed to work with it because it has the PS2 aesthetic, but the colors, I know AS400 had a lot of black, and, there might be more of a use of, I think the AS400 continued, it was a more modern mini computer type system that continued compatibility with some very much earlier IBM mainframes and minis. So an 8-inch drive that was designed to work with a system that emerged in 1988 probably does make a lot more sense, for these systems than, say, somebody that somehow is loading a DOS file off of a PS2 PC. So, right. But yes, I think it looks like all of us were kind of at first glance tricked by the look of it. It doesn't look like an 8-inch drive. But anyway, that caught my eye as an anachronistic thing, with an interesting look. But that would wrap up what I have. That is a $600 item if you have an AS400 that you need to add an additional drive to buy it now with a make an offer. And it looks like shipping on that one is about a little over $100 from Minnesota to where I live.
Well, my AS400's in the shop at the moment.
But... yeah. You can have a treat waiting for it when it gets home. Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm. Yummy 8-inch drive. Yeah, wow. That was a good find, Blake. Whereas my auction just blatantly stole from Paul, but this looks so cool. And I've been kind of on a CPM kick recently between the K-Pro and the Altair and a couple of other things. So this also caught my eye as something opportune to steal from you. So looking at this, the pictures in this eBay auction for this Osborne, there's a couple of interesting things. One is the Osborne 1 seems to be in really nice cosmetic shape. As you look around it, you don't see a lot of discoloration, dings, or some of the other bad things that could, tend to happen with the Osborne 1. The other thing is it has an actual Osborne external monitor. I'd heard of these. I've never seen one in person. I don't think I'd ever even seen one on an auction. And it also looks like it's in good shape.
Mm-hmm.
So the bad news about this auction is that the computer doesn't work. It's also got some books and accessories that come along with it as well. The computer is non-functional, but I guess the silver lining of that is that the person selling it doesn't have some cheesy language like, don't know if it works, unable to test, etc. In fact, how do they, if you scroll down, I think the way they said it was tried to fire up, no dice. So nice, honest, straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
They say it might be a fuse or might be doing it wrong.
You could fix that.
Yeah.
You can fix that.
So who knows what the situation is, but you could fix it.
I think you definitely could.
And if you can't, it would be a most excellent Raspberry Pi enclosure.
Yes. I've never even seen a photograph of an external Osborne monitor. This is the first time ever. I had no clue that even existed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it, I mean, it's the you can see it has the, you know, Osborne plate on it.
Yeah, it's an Osborne badged monitor. So this is a really neat auction. What's it going for again? Oh, it's starting out at $1.
Yeah.
Yeah, $1. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's got 6 days left.
Mm-hmm.
But 6 days. But look at the, it's interesting to look at the construction of the monitor. I mean, clearly the top is this plastic shell, and you can just see, like, right in the middle of the front of the monitor is one screw. And then there's, you know, a screw on either side. It looks very, very, it almost looks kind of like a, what is it, the prop, you know, IKEA prop computer monitors, you know, which makes it all the more interesting because, you know, this is, I don't think a great deal of this, you know, design work went into this thing, which makes it kind of more cool as far as an artifact from history. Wow. Mm-hmm. That's something.
And the stuff that it includes is actually pretty cool too, you know, the books and the discs and stuff.
Yeah, I think just some work on the inside to get this to work, and you could have yourself a very nice Osborne One, along with the external monitor, which, you know, as Blake mentioned, is a unicorn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that is a unicorn. You leave that unplugged from that monitor and roll into Starbucks. Just pop that open, get your latte with your mask on.
You know, you would be styling.
You'll be the guy.
All right. What about you in eBay, Paul? What have you got?
I found just random stuff. But one thing that I found, I put this in the list. It's a IBM AT5170, a PC-AT. And it's a little bit beat up. The main reason I put it in is because it struck me as being actually somewhat cheap. Like, these surprisingly go for a lot. So this is, you could buy it. It's a buy it now for $200, starting bid of $150, which would be a lot for almost anything else. But I have kept an eye out for IBM ATs, and they just for some reason command a lot, and they don't come up all that often either. So, anyway, if you're looking for one, if you're looking for one and I haven't bought it, it's actually not very far away from me. So, I think I probably won't have bought it because where am I going to put it? I can't get to my office anymore.
And they're not small.
If you're
looking for a nice tiny little addition to your collection, it's probably not it.
Yeah.
Are they significantly wider than a 5150 or 5160? The PC and the XT?
It's about the same.
Okay. Yeah. I've been in the presence of them, but I don't think I've ever seen the two sitting extremely close together. But yeah, that doesn't mean that they're not big.
Yeah.
A little bit bigger certainly. Form factor, as I recall, but not significantly different, but still wide, still heavy.
Yeah. Yeah. I probably have said this in like five different prior episodes, but I have a kind of a soft spot for these because I had one at work when I was in high school. And, you know, so I was always like putting cards in and stuff. And, you know, like I feel like I interacted a fair amount with this box. It has a little key. I don't know what the key's for. I don't know if we ever even had the key. But
yeah, they were expensive at the time, I remember.
Yeah, you mentioned the 286 Atari machine, and I guess that's what these were too, right? I mean, I think these were 286s.
6 megahertz 286, and I think they cost between $5,000 and $6,000, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, I think they were very expensive. I have on the shelf a number of magazines. I know Personal Computing is one, where you know half of the magazine is devoted to different takes on like managerial level people determining whether this or that worker needs an AT or a PCXT because the expenditure was so great. Like they were going into, okay, what sort of work do they do? All right, now this is an advantage here. And it was just a 6 megahertz 286, you know, versus, but that's a lot faster than a 4.77 8088.
Well, I can tell you it felt a lot faster. I had the option in the computer room, you know, sometimes I would wind up working on the XT and sometimes I would work on the AT and, you know, I would specifically go in overnight so that I could use the AT because it was much, much faster.
Yeah.
The ATs were speedier, but you're right about the cost differential that I can attest to. We had at Hughes Aircraft, fleets of the XTs. And when the AT was available, you really had to have a quantifiable need to score one of these. Otherwise, you were getting an XT.
Dude, you're getting an XT.
Right. That was the thing. It was, should we buy four PCs, XTs, or, one or two ATs? How does it work?
Mm-hmm.
And, the articles, they were practical articles because, it was really expensive.
Okay, let's see. So next one is not all that interesting. It's Mac LC475, and this is notable because it is, again, it's one of those computers that you can put the 2E card in, so that you can have both a classic Mac. It's actually, I think, one of the later options, like one of the last, one of the most capable Macintoshes that can run the 2E card.
Mm.
It has in it, I believe what it has in it is an Ethernet card right now. So you'd have to take the Ethernet card out in order to put the 2E card in if you were going to do that. And it also doesn't start. I think it starts, but it doesn't have video. I think that's what it said.
Was that an AUX? I guess an AUX connector on the back?
It's something like that. It's one of those Ethernet standards that somewhere I have a box, a converter box for that. There's AAUI, and there's a couple of different types. Anyway, I thought it was kind of interesting just to point out the fact that there was an Ethernet card. This is, you can sort of see inside of the box, like how these processor direct slot cards went in.
Uh-huh.
There is a battery, and I can't quite tell if there is damage, but the fact that it shows no video suggests that maybe some capacitors have leaked in there somewhere.
So I guess that's a 6840, it looks like.
Yeah. I think the 475, I think, is the it probably is a 6840. It's as powerful as those little pizza box things got before they stopped accepting the processor direct slot cards.
Yeah, I think the LC3 was like a 25680/30, and that was as fast as it went. So this was a lot faster than that, actually.
Mm. Wasn't the Quadra that name? The quad part of that related to the fact that it was an 040?
Probably.
I thought that's what that meant.
That's a good point.
It's conceivable. I think that makes... I think this 475 might be the same thing as a Quadra 605 or something. There's some... Well,
that's where we get into the loveliness of Apple's marketing. Come on.
You want the names and numbers to make sense?
Yeah.
This is actually also at the moment relatively cheap. It's three bids have it up to $37. So like it's not. I think if this breaks 100, then you might start thinking twice. But if you're the fourth bid and get it for $38, then that's not bad.
Well, especially if you're talking about an entire recapping effort.
Yeah.
And maybe mitigating some damage on the main board or some of those other pieces due to the leaky caps, that might be a project. So you might be in for a project if you buy this as a fixer-upper.
Right. Do we know that this one has leaky caps, or did they say something about it?
No.
I think we just know that it doesn't show video. And it's also possible that they don't know how to make it show video.
Sorry. I didn't see but I didn't catch that detail. Okay. Well, maybe they'll keep it low and they don't know how to connect the video.
Because it's not – Macs of this era are not straightforward video-wise.
No.
So it's not just like plugging in a VGA monitor. You need an adapter with all the dip switches set properly.
With the dial, on it. I had an adapter that had this rotating like a wheel.
Yeah.
And you had to set the frequency. It was not standard.
Okay. And then the last thing I had, this actually came up in the previous episode, and I hadn't mentioned it, but actually I'm going to jump ahead a little bit in the stuff I'm sharing. So last time I mentioned the existence of the Apple line, which is it's basically part of an interface between a Apple Lisa or an Apple III and a mainframe. So it's essentially a way that you can use an Apple III or a Lisa to be a 3270 terminal. Right, so last time was about terminals, and so we talked about this. And so there is a, on bitsavers.org, there's a marketing document. It's a sales reference guide for the Apple Cluster Controller and Apple Line. And these two things, these are probably the rarest things that Apple ever made.
Yeah.
So, and the cluster controller particularly. I've seen photos of one. I mean, like, I know one exists. And then there's the photo on the front of the sales brochure. The Apple Line is, the cluster controller is basically it allows you to connect several terminals via Apple Lines. The Apple Line is something a little bit like a modem. It's a protocol converter. So you would plug that, like the Apple III, say, into the Apple Line, and then the Apple Line into the cluster controller, and then the cluster controller into your mainframe. I think that is how that works.
Wow.
And actually, Ben Edwards did a post some time ago. This is 2014, so 6 years ago now, about the Apple Line, where he called it the one of Apple's two rarest products, and he's, you know, the cluster controller is the other one, where he sort of talks a little bit about the fact that these are impossible to find. And I think I was hypothesizing about this that maybe the reason that they're so hard to find is that, first of all, I mean, like, it's only a large business would have gotten one of these because, you know, you're using it to interface with your mainframe. And I think they may have been leased. So, so you know, they would return them to Apple, who would presumably destroy them. They're hard to find. I have one, I know of like two others. You know, so they're not impossible to find, but they're a challenge to find. It turns out though that really once you have them and look inside them, they're the same thing as the DCA IRMA print protocol converter. And you can buy one of those for $20. So if you don't care about the Apple badge on the front, then you could get one of these like super rare things for $20. I have yet to actually quite
interesting
cave in.
And it'll work, just drop in? It works straight up?
It's not – the one thing that is different – I don't know if they opened this one in the auction. I guess they didn't. There's a different ROM inside. So there's some kind of firmware code that Apple has that's different from – what you would get with the IRMA print. But everything else, I think all of the other connectors and what it looks like inside, everything is basically, you know, it's basically the same device. So I think that's kind of interesting, at least, you know, that this super rare, impossible to find, you know, holy grail of an Apple item is also available for $20 plus, you know, $11 shipping.
Wow.
if you want to burn your own EEPROM or whatever. So
yeah, I'd never seen these before. The cluster controller with that crazy Apple logo sitting on a little block, a little adhesive block. It looks kind of like a Apple branded MSI that had been painted over with white. Looks sort of like a, you know, like an S100 bus computer.
Yeah.
Imagine finding one of those on the shelf at Goodwill. That would be, you know, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you look at this and it really does not even feel like a thing. But, I mean, like, it's a few people. I mean, the Apple Line at least looks a little bit like an Apple IIc Aero modem or something like that.
But with those angled lights.
Yeah. But the cluster controller doesn't, you know, doesn't look like anything. I mean, it really looks like a box. It's the one stuck an Apple sticker on practically.
Right. Wow.
So,
and anytime I hear IRMA or Forte, I still have a little shudder because their products back in the day were so insanely expensive. The 3270 cards that you could put in a PCXT and turn it into an IBM mainframe terminal worked well, but they were so much money.
It seems strange that you had that so much hardware was required to interface. I mean, 3270, there's software 3270 emulators, but I guess physically it was just... You know.
Well, what I remember of the cards and, you know, not being an electrical engineer, I couldn't tell you for sure, but the cards look pretty packed. So at least for early 80s to mid 80s technology, it wasn't trivial what they were doing on that card. It was almost like they were putting all the brains of a 3270 inside the XT.
Okay, maybe a lot of it handshaking, checksum, hardware, you know, different kind of things like the encoding. Yeah, it could be things that CPUs wouldn't be up for at the time. You know, I could say, yeah, I guess so. I'd like to. That's something that I'm going to remind myself to go look into that. That's probably an interesting little bit of history there.
Yeah, I wasn't able to remember DCA or IRMA last time when I was trying to talk about this, but I wanted to do this project where I would essentially run Hercules on something like a Raspberry Pi or just some kind of computer and connect it up to a terminal controller, something like the cluster controller, and then to the Apple line to my Apple III. I have the 3270 software for the Apple III. So,
well, that would be super fun.
So someday I'm going to do that. And actually, somebody just posted on the vintage computer, like the CC talk list, that they'd done that. I should try to find that. But someone has actually essentially done that, gotten Hercules running on a Raspberry Pi, and then was trying to do all of this connection. I'm going to see if I can find that while other talking is happening.
I never did all the connection, but I got Hercules running on a Raspberry Pi. I thought it would be hilarious to run it on a Raspberry Pi Zero.
Yeah.
So I had this teeny tiny little Wi-Fi capable computer that I took up to the main level and showed my family. I said, "Hey, you see what? See how small this looks? Well, it's a mainframe." And then locked into it with a terminal emulator and ran a couple of programs. It was hilarious.
That's pretty good. Yeah, I ran across I'm looking at the IRMA board for the PC that you mentioned, which is the 3270 interface. And yeah, it's a full-length board that is completely packed with chips, the image there. That's a 100% full-length board. So yeah, there's not anything trivial going on there, I don't think. Some probably buffer memory and encoding, decoding. And, wow, yeah.
That looks very familiar.
I found the message, Mattis Lind. He was documenting doing that same project, essentially, that I was thinking about, which is trying to run Hercules, but then make all those connections so that the Apple III can actually serve as a terminal for it. And so I actually went out and got, you know, like the IBM, I think it's 3174, you know, terminal controller that I would need to connect to the Apple line. You know, so I've got almost all the pieces, but. So someday I will.
You get all this going, you could sell time sharing.
Great. Yeah. Boy, that'll be my retirement fund. Anyway, I think that is all I had.
Well, then we can do parting shots. Then what do you guys think? Blake, why don't you kick us off?
I do have an actual parting shot that I want to focus on. I have, and you reminded me, with Sepp Tandy, behind me I have a Tandy Color Computer 3 that I got in very good condition, and I added not one of the new versions, but an old, you know, contemporary to its time, 512K expander. I have Tandy had the RGB out on the Coco 3 out the bottom of the unit, and I have a S-Video adapter, so I can clearly, you know, show it on some monitors that I have. And I wanted to get to, you know, BBSing with it, and so it's kind of a strange situation, the way, and, you know, anyone who knows the Color Computer config is aware, it has a, you know, I guess you'd call it a cartridge slot, but you know, it's disk drive interface, several audio cards. I think there's a light pin interface. These are all also use that slot. And so you can't really, you know, you obviously run into a problem as far as, well, what if you simultaneously want to, you know, use, like, the Tandy has something called a Bitbanger port on it, which is sort of a serial port. It's driven entirely by the CPU and it's not buffered, but they have a proper RS-232 card. But, you know, if you plug that into the cartridge port, how are you going to load your terminal program? So they had a big four cartridge interface called the multipack interface, which was designed for the original Tandy and the the original Coco, the Coco 2, it didn't fit physically with Coco 3. I think there are ways people would, you know, shift the unit to make it work. I mean, it electrically works, but I think it physically had an issue. Well, someone started making 2 and 3 slot versions of these with a 3D printed little board with a 3D printed minimal case, dramatically smaller. So I picked up one of these as with my one of my Tandy hauls. I got the proper RS-232 card. So I hooked it, you know, to the Wi-Fi 232. I have a drive pack SD card ROM interface. So I have them both sitting in the two slots. You know, it lets you use two cartridges simultaneously. So you can have, you know, you can load data off of one, and electrically from the Coco, it can access a device that's plugged into this as if it's basically a slotted, you know, a slotted system. So I have done, you know, some terminal use with the Bitbanger port, and that's fine, but it's slow. What I want to do is use, there's a really nifty ANSI compatible terminal program from a guy that calls himself Sockmaster. And I think it's called Terminus or Midnight Twilight Term. Anyway, it's a great terminal program, but I can't for the life of me get it to work with the RS-232 interface, which is needed. I'm getting characters that repeat on and on, or in a different mode, I'm getting nothing, or I'm getting garbage, and so I've toiled with it. And I'd really like to get it working, and I, you know, I need to keep just try different approaches with it, but I've almost exhausted everything, you know, that I have in my head, so I'll probably post to some forums, but I think it'd be interesting to get that system you know, on the BBSs, because the Coco 3 is really, it's an amazingly powerful, you know, 8-bit computer. And, it would be fun to, you know, to have a way to use that frequently, because I don't have Coco in my history. So when on the rare occasion that I've collected a system like that, it's not really a nostalgic thing for me so much as if I could find a way to use it now that lets me appreciate it. Mm. So that's what I need to do for that. So we'll see how that goes. I'm determined to try to, you know, really get that working. And it's impressive what the machine can do. I think it's arguably, with its 6809, you know, arguably the most powerful 8-bit computer as far as, you know, what the CPU can deliver. And and there's a great community around the Coco. So we'll see. That'll be fun. Hope I'll report back if I have success or if I don't. And so that's what I'll be doing.
Yeah, I would really like to get to know the Coco 3 a little better. I mean, like, it's one of those things that's kind of been on the list for a long time. But it was a few years ago, there was a presentation at Kansas Fest about the 6809. Basically, we had someone come in who was essentially a Tandy person, but and gave a presentation about, you know, like why you might want to use the 6809 instead. But it was really super interesting, because we all knew the 6502, and you know, so you can sort of appreciate we have all these extra registers and all this other stuff, you know, like you can see how you would use it. And ever since that, I've been pretty interested in trying it.
That wasn't Boise Petrie, was it?
No, it wasn't. It's the guy who wrote Farfall.
Boise is one of a Tandy guy who did the interesting, and I know I think you talked about it on the show before I became involved with the show. It was I did a blog post about this, and he took a 6809 and 6809E and placed it in an Atari XEGS and wrote some demos running on it. Like, so it was basically, it had the custom chips of the Atari, which, you know, are nice to have, and then a dramatically more powerful 8-bit CPU. And, that was sort of next level, I thought, to get that working. Mm. Yeah.
It's John Linville from the Coco Crew podcast.
Okay.
But also, he was in the Mega podcast from 2015 as well. So he's an RCR host also of a sort.
Well, that's cool. I'd like to learn some more about the Coco 3 at some point as well. I have no mileage whatsoever with the Coco line, but 6809 is fascinating.
Yes.
I did pass up, like I passed over one of those multi-cartridge things when I was searching through eBay. Like I didn't put it in my list, but I did see it. So someone is selling one.
The Tandy one or the...
I think it was the Tandy one for the color computer, but...
Yeah, with it, the thing with the Tandy one is, right, if you wanted to use it on a Cocoa 3, which you, is probably right. the one, you know, if you're coming into it, oh, I want to check out the Cocoa, you probably want to, you know, get the 3. It takes some work to get that working with it, apparently, which is why, you know, I guess, you know, with this guy, they weren't expensive. Like, I wish I'd, maybe, you know, we can, in the show notes, I can find that link, but it wasn't very expensive, and, you know, it just takes no space, and it works with the Tandy. With a 3 or 2, you flip a switch or something like that, so... Mm-hmm. So with a 3, I intentionally didn't really want to, you know, seek out a Tandy one. And it's also huge, you know, like it's wide almost as the machine itself. Mm.
Well, what about you, Paul? Any, closing remarks?
Not really. I have not had very much time to do much retro stuff. And it's getting, that always seems to be true, but, I'm surrounded by it at least, you know, in a sense I have it more around me than maybe I did before because I still have my Apple III next to me and my 2C Plus right here, you know, and, I'm always looking at my little, I guess it's, not super visible, but I have these, Raspberry Pi cases that Charles Mangan made, you know, that like it's a little Apple III, and I have a little 2C.
Oh, cool.
You know, so I have all my little retro toys around me, comforting me as I do my non-retro work.
Nice. I keep my my Lego Apple IIc close at hand, but then, good. Of course, my room really doesn't need that.
Yeah, that's true.
Somehow I managed to weather the lack of retro computing with this Lego item.
That's right.
Yeah. It's right now sitting on top of my 2C. So, yeah. All right.
Well, on my side, I only have one parting shot, which is that occasionally I'll swing back through the RCRs that I wasn't on to look at things like the notes or the gift guide. And I saw an awesome T-shirt, which was a takeoff from the video of Steve Ballmer running around like crazy and shouting, developers, 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 developers. That music video is one of just my all-time favorite things in the history of ever. So I saw this T-shirt that commemorated that video, and I thought, oh my gosh, that's great. And then when I went and actually looked at the entry online, I found out made by none other than Jack Nutting, member of the RCR. So I was so incredibly happy about that. That will definitely be going up in my clothes rack.
Excellent. Yes. Excellent. Yeah, I think that was a week when we couldn't think of anything, and we were trying to start. And so he's like, oh, I know.
Oh, that's a great choice. I don't even care if it was a shameless plug or not.
Right.
It was perfect. All right. Well, I guess that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for all RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at vcfed.org. And just click on the forum link there. You'll find us. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group. As Paul mentioned, as long as you can answer those tricky questions, just to show that you are not a robot. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We love to get feedback. We love to read it. We love to talk about it. We're a member of the Throwback Network that you can find at throwbackreviews.com. And if you enjoy the show, or if you don't, either way, feel free to write a review of RCR over on iTunes. Thanks for watching and or listening. And until next time,
Retro Compute!